eventually its conditioning and habits cut from that, its roots, and then its subtle instincts. Once that's all cut, then we reach a state of the mind. So it all starts from a simple thing such as chanting. Just like a small seed planted in the ground can grow into a very large and very wonderful tree, providing fruit for many, many beings for a long time. Like that, even a simple prayer invoking the blessings of the three jewels can bring tremendous results. Tremendous result. So that's the reason we start with a little chanting before we actually do the prayer. Actually, chanting is much, much more extensive, but because we have started late tonight, then I've cut it short. Then the teachings that we're going to, that I have the honor to give all of you, and all of you I rejoice that you're able to receive, is called the 8 verses of mind transformation, 8 verses of thought transformation, 8 verses of mind change, whatever you like to call it, because there's no standard English translation. But it's 8 verses or 8 steps or 8 methods that we should follow as guidelines in our life to transform our mind to become a person that's highly beneficial, that's highly good or beneficial for society, for others. So this is called the 8 verses of mind transformation. Before we actually do the 8 verses of mind transformation, I would like to talk a little bit about motivation, independence on the 8 worldly concerns. So that's very, very important, the 8 worldly concerns. And that would affect our motivation. A motivation would affect the action and its result. So that's very, very important. Since we have started late tonight, I realize that it's a working day. Tomorrow is also a working day. So actually we should start at 8, but I'm sure all of you got stuck in traffic and we started a little late. I'm here only until Sunday. So after Sunday, I'll be taking off for China for about 10 to 11 days, and then I'll return back here and start a teaching course again. So while I'm gone, before I leave, I would like to have the honor to impart some Dharma to all of you. So it's just for a few days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, for about an hour and a half each evening. So I request you all to please try to make it for at least all these 3 days so that the transmission, the teachings, is complete. So when you receive the teachings, as opposed to listening to it on tape, when you listen to it on tape, you get intellectual knowledge. When you actually receive it directly from the Lama, then you get the blessings, the transmission, and also the seeds to be able to accomplish what you're practicing. And then when you listen to it on tape again and again, it's quite beneficial, quite beneficial. So through the few years that I've spent in teaching Dharma, I found it most beneficial not to give a lot of rituals, not to give a lot of initiations, and not to give a lot of commitments to people. Although people are very sincere, and they're willing to take commitment, I feel it would be better if we spend more time to actually learn the Dharma, to learn the holy teachings of Lord Buddha. So it is in that motivation I'd like to give more Dharma talks as opposed to initiations. Whereas in 1992, when I first came, I gave a lot of empowerment initiations, thinking that since Malaysia has a large Chinese community, I thought that there would be many, many Buddhists and far advanced practice. So I find that all of the great lamas who came here taught that. So consequently, no one taught any of the basic teachings. Not that the people are not good or the lamas are didn't do it, but we all thought that everybody here had been studying for years. So everybody came and gave empowerments. So what I like to do now is to actually give you the Dharma talk and maybe think about empowerments a couple of years down the line. And in the empowerments that you have received, this will definitely add to it. So the empowerments that you have already received, I rejoice. So the teachings that we plan to engage in this place is to reinforce the empowerments, to give more understanding, and then basically to learn the Dharma. And that's very, very, very important. And I'd like to teach you all the Dharma in a organized, systematic, logical, clear, concise way. Rather than we ring a lot of bells, throw a lot of rice, you've got a blessing, everybody goes home, I fly back to India, and see you next year. So I've been doing that, you've been doing that, and we're still here. And not much progress yet, with all due respect to the other great lamas. So I try a new method. No bells, no much rituals, no this, no empowerments. We do Dharma. We learn Dharma, we systematically learn it from time to time. And then some of the people actually are quite advanced in practice into the higher tantras. So for those people that are quite advanced in the higher tantras, after I return from China, I would like to start a program of very private teachings for a small group that has taken empowerment and have questions on it. Because that can only be taught with people who have the empowerment. So they have received it before. So I would like to do that. Perhaps one of the classes would be, I'm not sure, but maybe Vajrayogini at that time. We'll see. In any case, so today, tomorrow, and Friday, I plan to give the 8 verses of mind training. So I implore you and ask all of you to try to make it. And we try to come by 7:30, and we can start early, and we go home early, and we get to sleep early, and then come back here early again tomorrow. And then if everything goes as planned, now everyone's not tired. We've all been talking about Tsongkhapa, we've all been reciting Tsongkhapa, we've all been saying Tsongkhapa this, Tsongkhapa that, beneficial, wonderful, it's a Buddha. So Tsongkhapa is that large monk figure which is not fully dressed. I plan to dress Tsongkhapa tomorrow night, so he'll look like me or I'll look like him tomorrow night. He'll be all dressed up tonight. He's not dressed up, he's a little bare, but never mind. He still looks beautiful. So on Saturday, we'll go along. I'll consult with my committee members. I'll let you know by tonight, before the teaching's over. The committee members, please think what time you would like to do the Tsongkhapa teachings on Saturday. Perhaps it would be good in the evening, like now. I'd like to give you a commentary, an explanation on Tsongkhapa's short and concise 7 limb practice, which is about a page and a half. It's very short. What we just recited, actually. Its meditations, its benefits, its lineage, and how to say, and any questions you may have on that. So I'd like to do that on Saturday. And Sunday at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, because the economic situation around this area is not so good. So on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I'd like to do a Zambala Puja to dedicate it to the economy of the people here and to this country and in general to the region. So I would invite all of you to also participate. It's not an initiation. It is a simple puja. It is called a Zambala water offering puja. And then we'll be making offerings to Zambala water, and I'll explain where that ritual came from, that practice, its origins, and it did originate with Buddha Shakyamuni himself. So 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then we'll make a lot of tormas or balls, little barley, oat flour balls mixed with sugar and butter and milk and nice delicious things. And then we each will be able to take one and offer it to Zambala. The usual ritual is the Lama does all the offering. And this time we'll make it different. Everybody will take one, recite Zambala's mantra and offer it for the sake. At that time when you hold the ball, then you will think about the personal prayers that you had and the personal wishes you want to accomplish. And then kasa. And especially think about the economic situation and offer to Zambala. You do not need to bring anything, just yourselves and a good motivation. No money and nothing is required. You just come yourself, we will prepare everything. You collect the merits, go home happy, and we'll clean up afterwards. So we'll do that today, tomorrow, and Friday. We'll do 8 verses of thought transformation. We might finish a little earlier, we might finish a little later. If I finish a little earlier, I'll start Zambala Friday. We'll see, we'll let it flow. And then, Karsa, Saturday will be Tsongkhapa School of Yoga as planned. And then Sunday will be the Zambala Puja. And I think Sunday evening I'll be taking off. And then I'll take off to Singapore, from Singapore to China. From China, 10, 11 days. And then come back here. And then we'll start classes again and teachings and puja. So that'll be very, very nice. For the old faces, not old in age, but old in knowing you for many years. I'm very happy to see all of you again. Very, very happy. And for the new faces, I hope you become very old faces. Nice to see all of you. Thank you very much for coming and spending your precious evening here receiving the Dharma. Thank you very much for making an effort. It's really, really wonderful that we can gather together, pray together, and we can listen and do holy activities together. So since it's already 9:15, we'll take a vote, we'll make it democratic. Usually the Lama says, whatever. whenever. But we'll take a vote. Tonight, what time should we stop? Since we started late. So I beg all of you, please try to get here by 7:30. We start at 7:30, 7:45, and we finish early, because my plan was to finish 9:30. So we continue on that plan. We have 15 minutes, and guess what? 8 verses cannot fit in. So what do you all think? Give me a time that we should stop at tonight, because I realize you have to go home, wash, and prepare for work.
Will 10:30 be too late? No objection?
Is 10:30 okay? Raise your hand. Majority okay? Majority okay? So we make it between 10:15, 10:30, alright? Hour will be alright. Tomorrow we finish, try to finish at 9:30, because if we can get here early, it will be very good. We do a few minutes of chanting, alright? Then, this was typed out today by Mr. Ganesha, and this is the text that we'll be using on thought transformation. So after you receive this, please keep this with your prayer books, and it should be recited every day. It's not a commitment, it's a recommendation. And it'll be very beneficial, very, very beneficial. Yeah, Chuck. Tradition of all Dharma talks, before the Dharma talk starts, the teacher and the ones being taught should have a superior motivation. Okay, you give it concept, it's okay. Only one that nothing to do. Then the one teaching and the one to be taught should have a good motivation. The one that is teaching should be knowledgeable, should have received the transmission. The teachings, the lineage, have studied thoroughly what is to be taught, and practicing. I do not fit that qualification, but I'll act like I do. So you play along with the act. So we should have the transmission, we should be able to, we are practicing it actually. And the motivation for teaching is to give you knowledge on the methods to become a fully enlightened being. From the side of the teacher. The side of the student, one should be free from the three faults. As explained in the Lamrim, like the three cups. The first cup having holes, the second cup or the second pot having dirt and defilements inside, and the third cup being turned upside down. So the student should be free of the three faults as represented, symbolized by the three cups. The first cup is the holes. When you pour something into the cups, if there's a hole, then the liquid naturally cannot stay. Likewise, when you receive the holy Dharma, if you never retain it, contemplate on it, think about it, practice it, it's like it goes in one ear, it goes out the other. Dharma is very holy, it's very, very important. It's not entertainment, it's not something to be done when we are happy, and it is not to be done when we have time, it's not to be done only when we are in a good mood. But Dharma is something to be practiced 24 hours a day, constantly, vigilantly, therefore you will get results. So we should be free of the first fault, which is a cup having holes, which is not retaining, contemplating, thinking about, and practicing the Dharma over a period of time. Definitely, if we practice the Dharma over a period of time, there will be results. Absolutely, there will be results. And there are living proof of many people who have results. So, like that, that we should be free of the second fault, which is the cup that is contaminated. So that means that the people receiving the Dharma should be received with a completely positive and good motivation. And the motivation is on the lowest scope, to be free of the three lower realms. On the medium scope, to be free from the lower realms and to have compassion for others. And the highest scope, you wish to receive Dharmas solely for the sake of others, that you may become a fully enlightened Buddha to benefit others. So those are the three scopes that make you qualify to receive the Dharma. So we will naturally develop the highest scope that will be the most beneficial. So in that way, any other motivation, I will attain a Dharma class to receive methods to gain wealth, merits, I can change my luck so I can become rich, meet a girlfriend, etc., etc., would be like a cup with defilements. When you pour something good into it, it's still unusable. Still unusable because it's become contaminated. So we should be free of the second fault as symbolized by the cup with contaminations. The third one is the cup that's upside down. To sit in a Dharma talk without an open mind, with your ears closed, falling asleep, bored, or not wanting to accept, and just sitting there and kind of like a social event, and then whatever is said is said, whatever is not said is not said, is like a cup upside down. Whatever you pour into the cup, naturally you cannot retain it. So we should be free of the three faults as symbolized by the three cups. Very, very important during Dharma talks. The teachings of the eight verses of thought transformation. Teachings of the verse eight thought transformation is very important. In all traditions, we must state the lineage, state where its sources. We cannot simply just give a Dharma talk or a ritual empowerment and just say, oh, it's Dharma. We must give its source. We must quote its authenticity. Without authenticity, then we cannot just listen to made-up Dharma talks. It will be of no benefit. So its authenticity must be revealed, and then the person giving it to you must have the lineage himself or herself. Without that, then you will not receive any transmission or blessings from the teachings. So very important. The original teachings on the eight verses of thought transformation, of course, originated from Buddha Shakyamuni himself. Buddha Shakyamuni initially developed bodhicitta and acquired the merits of both profound insights and great deeds for three countless aeons, finally achieving great awakening. So Buddha Shakyamuni practiced for three great aeons to become a fully enlightened being by purifying his negative karma and collection of positive karma. Then after Buddha Shakyamuni became enlightened, he gave the teachings on compassion to his disciples, which were passed down to the great Indian Buddhist Pandita, Aryabhasanga, and Nagarjuna. Then these were passed down to highly enlightened beings, such as the great Shantideva. Shantideva was the one that actually emphasized, reiterated, and expanded on the talks of compassion by the Buddha. And he put it into words that were even more easier for us to understand. But the root text was, of course, Buddha Shakyamuni. So the teachings of thought transformation arose from this text called Bodhisattva Chaitavatara, which is development of bodhicitta, great compassion, written by Shantideva, and its root text, of course, from Buddha Shakyamuni. So Shantideva was the one that made it very, very famous, the practice of bodhicitta. After that, it came to the great Lama Selimpa, who was the root guru of Adisha. This was passed down to Adisha. From Adisha, he came from India, came to Tibet, and spread the teachings all over Tibet to countless disciples. Out of the countless disciples that came, he passed it down to his main disciple, who was a layman, who was one of the previous incarnations of His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, the great Je Zhongdongba. So Zhongdongba, in turn, practiced, achieved these teachings, and passed it down to his many students. Among them, chief was the monk Gishi Potawa, Gishi Sharawa, Gishi Langmi Tangba. So Gishi Langmi Tangba received the teachings from Zhongdongba directly. He thought it was very profound, and he thought that it would be beyond the thought of ordinary people, and he felt it would be a tremendous loss if they were not preserved. So these teachings were very profound yet simple, and until then it was not practiced publicly, but it was passed down to a few very qualified disciples. So years later, the great Geshe Langri Thapa passed away, and he wrote it down for the first time. Before Geshe Langri Thapa, it was always given orally, never written down. There was no text. So Geshe Langri Thapa, out of great compassion, decided that the teachings must not be lost, wrote it down. When he wrote it down, he passed away. Years later, one great master called Gishi Chekawa found one verse a piece of scripture, one verse of the teaching that said, may I accept the defeat myself and offer the victory to others. May I always suffer defeat and offer the victory to others. So Gishin Chekpa was very, very intrigued by this statement, very moved and very touched by this statement, because this statement represents the essence and the complete embodiment of all the Buddha's teachings. So this sentence contains all of Buddha's intent and all the Buddha's teachings in one line. May I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. So he was very, very moved by this, determined to meet the author of the text. Then Gishin Chekpa went all over looking. When he came to one of the students of Gishin Langitangpa, he found out from the student that Gishin Langitangpa had passed away. So in a small town near Hasa, he met another master called Gishin Sharawa who was practicing. From there, he received more and more teachings. And from then on, Gishin Chekpa started to teach it openly to others, openly in public teachings like now. And then, from Gishin Chekpa, a long line of teachers, student to disciple, these teachings were passed until they reached the great king of Dharma, Tsongkhapa. From Tsongkhapa to his disciples, such as Khetru Rinpoche, Getsa Rinpoche, this was passed down to the long line of lamas, to His Holiness Pabongka, to His Holiness Trijang Rinpoche, and down to His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. So I receive these teachings, its transmission, its oral transmission, its blessings, its commentary, in Washington, New Jersey, in 1979. So I was approximately 11 or 12 years old at that time. But I remember it very clearly. His Holiness was sitting on a throne in the mountains, because that area is quite mountainous, and there was a white butterfly circling him through the whole time, and there was rainbows in the skies. But I saw myself hovering over His Holiness, giving this talk, and that was the first time that I had the honor and the great fortune to see His golden face, to receive teaching. So this was the first teaching that I ever received from His Holiness. So today I pass the teaching down to all of you. Although I am not qualified, definitely His Holiness is qualified. So I invoke His blessings and I invoke His grace that all of you may be able to practice, learn, understand, and practice these holy teachings. So the lineage is something like that. I just give you the short lineage. The lineage of the teachings on the eight verses of mind transformation is Buddha Shakyamuni, Arya Asanga, Pandit Nagarjuna, Shantideva, Lama Silingpa, Adisha, Gishin Pohawa, Gishin Sharawa, Gishin Langitangpa, Gishin Chekpa, and below that, a long lineage, Tsongkhapa, then His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, then myself, and now you. So this is a short Khalsa lineage. So I'm letting you know where the source of the teachings came from, its lineage, its authenticity, and when and where I have received it from. So with that aside, then I can proceed. So, number one, when we do any kind of Dharma actions, when we do any kind of Dharma activities, anything, lighting one incense, making prostrations, making offerings, offering flowers, giving donations to temples, giving dana to monks, sweeping the temple, driving or buying supplies for the temple, or being committee members of the temple, etc., etc. Meditations, chanting, anything. It should be free from the eight worldly concerns or the eight worldly dharma. Dharma means conduct. So Buddha Dharma is correct conduct. Dharma itself is just conduct. So the eight mundane concerns or the eight worldly concerns, the mundane is of this world. So mundane or worldly is exactly the same. I'll use the words back and forth. So the eight worldly concerns, we should not be practicing Dharma for these reasons at all. So we should not do any religious or spiritual actions with the intent, motive, that we will receive pleasure for the six senses. We will be free of unpleasant things for the six senses. Okay, let's use this text directly. Let me see that. Let me share it with you. Eight worldly concerns, to be free, to become happy when we are praised, to become unhappy when we are insulted, to be happy if we receive a gift, to be unhappy if we don't, to be happy upon achieving reputation, to be unhappy when we are unsuccessful, to be happy when we are comfortable, to be unhappy when we are not. So any Dharma action should be free of those 8 worldly concerns. If our Dharma is preoccupied with the 8 worldly concerns, there are many, many disadvantages. When we do any action with the 8 worldly concerns, the act will lead to rebirth into lower realms into the future. Future lives will be spent also with uncontrolled attachments like now. All results of uncontrolled delusions, attachments, and negative states of mind now is a sign that they have not been controlled in the past. So if it was not controlled in the past, definitely the result is that we have not gotten it under control at this time. If it is not gotten under control at this time, then it can only get worse, not better. So future lives will be also spent with uncontrolled attachments. One cannot ever enter the Mahayana path. One cannot reach liberation. So if you do any Dharma actions with the 8 worldly concerns, any practices that you do, you will not gain liberation. One will constantly experience hindrances into one's meditational practices. Hindrances of laziness, sleepiness, procrastination, doubt, instability, and that's the inner. The outer one is financial problems, time constrictions, responsibilities, etc., etc. So when we practice Dharma in a way that the motive is not free of the 8 worldly concerns, then the results, of course, will not be positive. And while we're practicing, we'll experience many inner and outer obstacles. And there will be no fruitioning of our practice except we plant seeds for future lives. The practice becomes only a service to the 8 worldly concerns. So what happens is that when you practice the Dharma with any of the 8 worldly concerns, what happens is that it actually feeds the 8 worldly concerns. So how is that? When you practice the Dharma so that you will be praised, the point of practicing the Dharma is not to be praised, not to be recognized. The point of practicing the Dharma is to reach liberation. So if you help a Dharma center, or you work in a Dharma center, or you do meditations, or you meditate wonderfully when people are around, when no one's around, you pick your teeth, then definitely you're not practicing the Dharma with a correct motive. So when our friends are around, when we gather around, we raise our eyebrows, the whites of our eyes are there, we have great meditational experiences, we see lights, our hairs go up, and our tears come down. The minute our friends disappear, we go out for a coffee break. So I think we're practicing Dharma for praise. So if you're practicing Dharma for praise, the very practice of Dharma leads to wanting more praise, increasing the big ego, therefore leading you to the 3 lower realms. You may think, hey, how can practicing the Dharma lead us to the 3 lower realms? Practicing the Dharma doesn't lead you to the 3 lower realms. Your negative intent before the action leads you to the 3 lower realms. You can sweep out an old folks' home with a good motivation, may this act benefit others, that act will lead you to Buddhahood. You can sit in front of Tsongkhapa and meditate for 5 hours, and meditate on the US dollar, and meditate your economy moves up, and that you can get some wealth face, some wealth mantra, some wealth puja, and that you'll definitely cancel everything to make it on Sunday for the wealth prayers. Then if you meditate for 5 hours in front of Tsongkhapa, you're meditating for material gain. Meditation doesn't mean fulfillment of your worldly wishes, worldly concerns. Meditation and practice is for enlightenment. So therefore, when we do practice for the reason of getting praise, how can we label that Dharma practice? That is definitely not Dharma practice. In fact, that very act, that very motive makes the act result in fruitioning of more negative karma. So in fact, when we start practicing Dharma, instead of our wish to get praise decreasing, it increases. The more we go to a Dharma talk, the more we know, the more empowerments, the more teachings, the more knowledgeable, the more scholarly we become, the more advanced we do it, the more we can chant, the more we can teach, the bigger our ego, the bigger our pride, the bigger our arrogance, everything becomes bigger. And the whole point of learning Dharma is to decrease those points and, in fact, to annihilate or destroy those points. So when you go to Dharma, or you practice Dharma with a wrong motive from the beginning, it is not the Dharma teacher, or the Dharma environment that is at fault. It could be your ignorance at fault, or it could be that you know it and you have not applied the antidotes hard enough. It is definitely not the Dharma. I always use the example that if you do not know how to drive a car and the car has a slight accident, it's not the fault of the car, but it's the driver. So if you do not get results from your Dharma practice, it's definitely not the Dharma. It's not definitely the Dharma teachers, it's definitely not the Dharma itself. It's not the center, it's not the Dharma students, it's you yourself. Because if it had no results, our altar should be empty. There should be no enlightened beings there. So we should be prostrating to empty things. And there would be no living enlightened masters today like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Great Karmapa, His Holiness the Sakya Chinsen, His Holiness the Dujun Rinpoche, His Holiness the Badingo Kensei Rinpoche, His Holiness the Great Ganyan Chi Rinpoche. There would not be any enlightened masters around. Like my master, His Eminence, the Great Kensei Rinpoche, there would not be around. But there are living beings around that are enlightened and highly realized and extremely beneficial for others. Even the great Chinese Mahayana master, the nun, Reverend Qin Yin, in China. Definitely she's advanced in her practice. She's doing a lot more than I can ever do. So she must be advanced in her practice to be able to do that. So there are living examples around us of people who are practicing and practicing correctly. Therefore, how come we are not getting those results? We must ask, point the finger back here, not at the Buddhas, the Dharmas, the temple. Oh, I couldn't listen well because it was so hot and I was sweating. It's not my fault. Or at the Dharma teacher, or at the Dharma texts, or the Sangha. We must go back to the source. If the Dharma or the Dharma teacher or the Buddhas were at fault, as I said, the altar should be empty. But since there are living representations of the result of correct Dharma practice, the Dharma must be correct and we ourselves must be at fault. But we shouldn't be despondent or depressed. If we are at fault, the fault is impermanent. The impermanence is dependent on conditions. Therefore, we can change the conditions and bring an end to the wrong practice and start on the right practice. Definitely we can. So, when we do Dharma practice to get praised or to avoid insults, the very reason we're doing the practice is to get praised. So that's a very low aim, and the minute we don't get praised, we stop doing Dharma. So the fault is not Dharma, the motive. But we do Dharma practice to get gifts and to avoid not getting gifts, to get gifts, to get angpaos and all that. The minute we stop, if we don't get it, we get upset. Again, it's not the Dharma, it's our motive. If we do Dharma for good reputation, oh, he's so good, he's so holy, he's such a good person, he's a family person, he also goes to the temple, and he's so wonderful. The minute we stop getting praise, we suffer, we feel despondent, we don't want to meditate, we don't want to practice, we don't want to go join the temple, we don't want to listen to the Dharma, we don't want to meditate, we become despondent. Why do we become despondent? Not because we have not gotten the results, but the actual reason is because the very motive that we started with out of ignorance was wrong. So the Dharma is not at fault. Then, we wish to get Dharma to receive some material gain, success. So we go to the temple to listen, hoping it will change our luck. We go in front of the altar, kowtow, to change our luck. We make offerings to change our luck. We listen to the Dharma and recite lots of mantras. We go to empowerment to receive great blessings to change our luck so that we can hit the lucky number. Our economic situation moves up. We can get rich. I get a lot of questions from people. I've been chanting and praying, how come my business is not moving up? Because the very reason you're chanting and praying is not for your business to move up. So you are chanting and praying irregardless of whether your business moves up or not. So the minute your business doesn't move up, economically you go down, of course it's a natural human reaction that you feel sad and unhappy. But that's when you should actually increase your Dharma practice, increase your Dharma energy. You should take advantage of the situation. So if we practice the Dharma to move our economic situation up, that our company moves up, we can move a new company, we can do a merger, we can make more money, our stocks go up, whatever, then if that doesn't happen, we become despondent. We have used the Dharma for a very short-term benefit, and we don't derive the ultimate benefit from Dharma, which is freedom from complete suffering, not just business moving up. So when we practice the Dharma for the sake, when we see lamas, get divinations, get blessings, do rituals, sponsor pujas, for the sake of simply receiving wealth, increasing our wealth in as an end in itself, then Dharma has been brought down to a very low level, and the full purpose of Dharma is not fulfilled. So we should not practice Dharma with the intent that it will move our economic situation up, or to avoid the economic situation from going down. If we do that, the rebirth will be in the spirit realm. So whether you practice Dharma or you don't practice Dharma, if you're always miserly and selfish and always concerned about money, and you will do anything for money, the rebirth will be on the spirit realm anyway. But if you practice the Dharma, you have a chance to purify that karma. So it would be better to be a Dharma practitioner who's greedy and miserly and worried about money than a non-Dharma one. Because whether you're a Dharma practitioner or not, you still have the same faults. So it would be better to have the faults and Dharma, and there's a chance that you may not take rebirth as a spirit, and if you do, the time is less, the duration of that rebirth is less. So whether you practice the Dharma or you don't practice Dharma, your problems are exactly the same. Exactly the same. So if you're very sick, if you know a good doctor, and you know a good hospital, and you've been recommended hundreds of times to that place, you can get sick and you won't be as worried because you know that you can solve that health problem. Similarly, if you look deeply, whether you practice the Dharma or not, your situation, your problems arise from karma, not Dharma, not your relationship with Dharma. Definitely not. So therefore, whether you practice the Dharma or not, you have the same problems. But with the Dharma, if practiced correctly, it becomes a temporary remedial, a temporary remedy to help you get over your problems, and also gives you ultimate methods to get over your problems. How much effort you put into the practice is how much result you will get. So we should practice the Dharma not with any of these eight worldly concerns. Eight worldly concerns is very, very important. Then, we should not practice the Dharma simply when we are comfortable, when everything's going right, when everything's going wonderful, when money's okay, family's okay, there's harmony. The minute one of that goes out of balance, we stop the practice. Because if we're going to stop the practice because of that, we might as well not even begin, because definitely those things will happen. Why? We are in samsara. We have been in samsara for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of lifetimes, and definitely we have created the karmic causes and dispositions for disharmony, for financial problems, for difficulties to arise. Definitely. But it is out of fear and knowing that those difficulties will arise, we must look for a method. What more superior method than to destroy the fruitioning of the roots of those karma before they fruition by Dharma practice? So if we practice the Dharma sincerely, we will definitely get the results. And first step is motivation. And our motivation should be upon the guidelines of the eight worldly concerns. So our motivation should be free of those eight worldly concerns. From the very start, from the very start. But don't be even more despondent thinking, well, what about the offerings I've done? What about the dhanas? What about the pujas? What about the prayers, the meditation, offerings on my altar, etc., etc.? Definitely there's benefit. but it will be even more greater and more efficacious if it was done free of the eight worldly concerns. Antidotes to free yourself from the eight worldly concerns. And the eight worldly concerns are basic guidelines for us to follow to reshape and recondition our conditioning. Guidelines, not restrictions. Some of us think, oh, Dharma is so complicated, there's so many restrictions, there's so many minute details. Yes, there is, because we're complicated. We're full of minute details. So the Dharma is an antidote to this. Definitely, the antidote will match the problem. So I've always given an example before that. When we first go to school, examination, requirements, points that we need, getting there on time, doing our homework, etc., etc., years and years and years of constriction and requirements. And that's quite difficult. But when we finish school, the actual regimentation, requirements, and the regulations that we follow lead to freedom. What freedom? When you get your degree, you do any job you want, you pick what you want to do. Same as in Dharma, it's like school. When you follow the Dharma correctly, you follow its regulations and rules, this restraint leads to total freedom in the future. Same. So we shouldn't think of Dharma as walls. We should think of it as very kind guidelines given by an enlightened being to help us follow our life through by. And definitely, it will bring immediate results. Definitely, it will bring immediate results. But the motive must be correct. Antidotes. If one follows the eight worldly concerns, one is no better than an animal. Because an animal wished to be praised, receive food, receive good reputation, the males fight with each other to get the best females, same. They wish to be very comfortable, they wish not to be unhappy. So what's the difference between we and the animals? Except we do things more in a more sophisticated manner. So, we must think that. If we practice Dharma or we live our life with the eight worldly concerns, we are the same as animals, although we are not. And since we are higher and better than animals, we should actually have the motivation that's much better than animals. The object one sees is the projection of one's deluded mind. So everything that we perceive, this is good, this is bad, this is good, this is not good, is the result of our own negative karma. If the object that we are perceiving is inherent in itself, is real in itself, then everybody that sees that object must see it the way you see it. So everyone that sees an object, they will see it differently. The reason for that is because the result of their karma is different. Change the object into an object you are not attached to. There is nothing new in samsara. You think. You hang around here, there's nothing new. All the food that you have eaten, you've eaten. All the clothes that you like to wear, you've worn. All the cars you've driven, you've been around. Everywhere. You've done everything. You've slept, you've eaten, you've taken all types of medications, you've gone to all types of entertainments, you've tried all kinds of things. There's nothing new in samsara. You've done this for lifetimes and lifetimes, and when you die, you'll be doing it for more and more and more lifetimes. There's nothing new in samsara. There's nothing exciting to hang around for. There's nothing exciting to be attached to. Everything is the same. So wouldn't it behoove us to actually practice Dharma free of the eight worldly concerns, to become a Buddha to benefit others? Wouldn't that be a breath of fresh air? Then, if we do things on the basis of the eight worldly concerns, we will not have true happiness. In fact, we will have more suffering, whether we practice the Dharma or not. Sufferings come about by wrong actions. Wrong actions come about by wrong motive. So, whether you do the wrong motive and wrong actions through the Dharma or not, does not matter. It does not matter. So whether you practice the Dharma or not, if you have the eight worldly concerns and your motive is always wrong, you will have negative results. At least with Dharma, there's a 50-50% chance. And no matter how hard one tries in life, one will always have dissatisfaction, listlessness, depressions. Because the motive is the same, the method is always the same, and again, there's nothing new in samsara. So it gives you dissatisfaction, listlessness. a feeling of despondency at times. And then you must realize that everything is impermanent by nature. No choice, nothing lasts. What's the definition of impermanence? The definition of impermanence is any phenomenon or any item or any object or any thing. Any phenomenon is any object, thing, place, people, whatever. Any phenomenon, the impermanence means, the definition is any phenomenon that is dependent on another phenomenon or dependent on other causes for its existence. Any phenomenon that is dependent on other causes or other phenomenons for its existence. So therefore, people who are attached to praise, and if their happiness arises from praise, the happiness is deluded. Because praise is dependent on a lot of things. It's dependent on our actions, it's dependent on the stability of our actions, and it's dependent on having the stability of our actions, and then actually getting the praise and having the people around to praise you. And when you don't get it, you become unhappy. So praise is impermanent. It's not lasting. So if we depend on happiness from praise, we will definitely experience unhappiness again and again and again and again. Similarly, if our happiness is dependent on wealth or achieving wealth and only wanting wealth, wealth and the process of achieving it takes up a lot of time, takes up our youth, takes away our time from our family, takes away time from everything, and lots of sacrifices such as health, mental peace, and lots of sacrifices. We can even go off the deep end to achieve wealth, to do negative actions, things that break the law. And then when we actually achieve the wealth is unstable. We can lose it any time, the shares can go down, etc., etc. So all the energy we put into achieving wealth and then actually achieving it requires so many causes. And the causes themselves are impermanent. Therefore, if we base our happiness on wealth and achieving it and the process of achieving it, we will definitely suffer very badly. We will suffer constantly while we're trying to achieve it. When we achieve it, we will suffer. And when we achieve it, there's no guarantee that we will be able to keep it. And the minute we lose it, or there's a sign of losing it, we run to temples, we run to lamas, we run to divinations, we run to bomos, we run to magicians, we run to fortune tellers, we run to anybody who can save our wealth. And in the process, we suffer. And then when we actually lose it, we suffer even more. Some extremely. So when our happiness is dependent on wealth and achieving it and the process of it, from beginning to the middle to the end, it's total suffering. Total suffering. Mental, physical, environmental, outer, inner, constantly. And our ignorance is pervasive, very strong, to say that if we achieve that, we have happiness. Yet if we look around, people who are actually wealthy, how many of them are deeply at peace or have happiness in their minds? And when they have it, after they lose it, how do they feel? And that is the process of life. One day you will definitely lose it. If not in time, definitely at death. When you're born naked with nothing in your hands. It's a sign you could not take anything from your previous lives. So, when we think about it carefully, when we think about it constructively and from a right angle, all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. Empty of inherent existence does not mean empty of existence. It means empty of the way we perceive it exists. Therefore, when we check something, when we look at something, when we have attachment towards something, it itself does not exist the way we perceive. Example, wealth does not provide happiness. But we have a wrong perception that it does. We follow that. We run after that. And it's not that we don't achieve wealth and we become unhappy. It is the wrong perception that it brings happiness and believing it. And when it does not bring happiness, we suffer. So it's not the wealth that makes us suffer or losing it that makes us suffer. It is the wrong perception, the ignorant perception of what we think it can do for us when we get it. So it's the motive and the process that makes us suffer. Our wrong perception, our idealizations that make us suffer. Not the wealth, not losing it, not achieving it. So like that, with these two examples, we can plant those examples to everything around us and everything that has happened in our lives that has so-called disappointed us. It is our wrong projection and wrong attachment to it. It is not the object itself. So therefore, all objects are free of inherent existence. Inherent existence means existing on its own without causes. If wealth can exist on its own without any causes, definitely can bring us happiness, because it will be permanent. So if something can exist on its own, without dependency on causes, it will be permanent. If these things are permanent, it will bring happiness. Since wealth comes up under the classification of impermanent phenomenon, our grasping at it being permanent, when it is not, makes us suffer. Like when we meet someone new, we have a projection, this person is kind, compassionate, honest, will be loyal, and then when we find out later they are not, it is not that they are not and they are like that that makes us suffer, it is our wrong projection of that person and what we feel they should be like, and they didn't fit our projection. It is our wrong projection of that person or that phenomenon that we have suffered, not that person. So we go on ignorantly blaming other people, other situations, other things. And from that wrong projection and wrong perception, we shout, we scream, we hurt, we use harsh words, we kill, we steal, we lie, commit sexual misconduct, we use schismatic speech, we put others down. It is from that wrong perception we do all those negative types of actions. Those negative types of actions definitely will bear fruit. Since its roots is negative, of course the sprout or the result will be negative. So the things that makes us suffer is not realizing that things do not inherently exist on its own. Inherent. Things do not exist inherently on its own. That old phenomenon is impermanent. It is our stubbornness not to accept that fact and to put more into it than it is. It is our stubbornness to have the wrong projection toward an object of the five senses. And it not fitting our projections the way we think it should be, that makes us suffer. And the worst part of it is that we do not have enough wisdom, clarity of mind, meditational powers, and penetrating wisdom to actually see an object for what it really is. Therefore, we are stuck with two problems. Wrong perception due to delusional mind, due to wrong mind. Wrong perception, number one. Number two, a grasping at the wrong projected perception. So a grasping at the wrong projected, a grasping at the wrong projection, and wrong projection itself makes us suffer. What is grasping? When we meet someone, I'll give you an example, the same one. When we meet someone and we feel they should be this way, and we build all our hopes, that's grasping, on the way we think they should be. And when that person doesn't fulfill what we think they should be with our lack of wisdom, then they are bad. They are evil. They are negative. They are not good. I must fight them. I must get revenge. I must get them back. So it is actually not them if we use our wisdom. It is not them. It is our wrong perception and our lack of wisdom to perceive. And the lack of wisdom to perceive and wrong perception itself is impermanent, which means it can be removed. Because these two factors are based on other conditions to survive. Therefore, there is an end to suffering. Therefore, logically, since those very perceptions are impermanent, that gives us an implication clearly that there is eradication or annihilation or destruction of those actual causes that bring us unhappiness. So think about it. All our sufferings arise from wrong perception, wrong projection. Wrong projection of everything around us. From morning to night, we have wrong projection. That wrong projection can come from conditioning. That wrong projection can come from stubbornness, laziness, and selfish attitude. Ego, selfish attitude. Ego is the one that makes us basically have wrong projection. And then having that wrong projection and acting out on that wrong projection brings to unhappiness. Please think about it. This point is extremely crucial. I will make one round of Manjushri mantras to the Buddha of Wisdom that you all can realize this point at this time. While I'm doing the mantra, do not focus on the sound, do not focus on the mantra, and you yourself, think about what I have just said on wrong perception. Think carefully. This is very crucial. So, we should pray to Manjushri and Tsongkhapa for this realization, not for anything else. Surprise! We thought otherwise. It is our wrong to reiterate this very important and crucial point, this realization. It is our wrong projection of objects living and non-living. And acting out its projections that we suffer. So you check everything in your life. How much we have done that. In fact, 24 chujikish, I don't know. In fact,
chujikish,
in fact, everything, 24 hours from the time we were born up to now, and the acts we have done, are based on our projections. Some of them wrong, some of them correct. Now you think carefully. So the minute we stop this, or train in stopping this, the sufferings start to become less. The problems may remain the same, but you suffer less, and that's the point. And when you suffer less, you have clarity of mind, and therefore the ability to solve it. That's the whole point. So when you practice Dharma and you have a wrong projected expectation, your problem should be solved immediately now. That's very demanding of the Buddhas. And not that the Buddhas are not going to acquiesce or agree to your demands. But, so, think. All of the problems and difficulties arise from that. And the more we add on to the projection, the more we reinforce it, recondition it, recondition it, and recondition it again and again and again, our sufferings increase, increase, increase. Even if we get well, even if we get 500,000 cars, money, houses, fame, our sufferings become even more intense to the point of suicide, to the point of going berserk and crazy. So that's why people who have many things suffer greatly. People who don't have many things suffer greatly. Either way you suffer, because the cause of the suffering is present and there. Think about it. So how can you go to the Buddhas, go to Jesus Christ, go to God, and pray constantly that your suffering cease when you do not lift one finger to actually remove the cause of the suffering? Think about it. So, when we realize that point and we start acting in ways that start cutting out conditioning and projection and wrong view, wrong projection, you will see your sufferings become less, even if you have many problems to endure. And that's how great masters, great Dharma practitioners are always happy, always willing, always enthusiastic, always ever ready to help others, even though they may have hundreds of people criticizing them, hating them. They endure many difficulties, many problems, financial, physical, health, environmental, social. They may go through many different types of sufferings and problems, yet they will go on, teach, practice, help, and never lose their enthusiastic perseverance because they have realized that point. That's the reason, because they have realized that point. Until you realize that point, you are in samsara, your own samsara. Samsara is not a wheel on the wall that you get reborn from there to there. We all have our own samsara. And that is the crucial realization to cut it. Samsara is another word, suffering. Think about it. So, to support that growth, to support that meditation, to support that realization, to support that understanding, we must continuously collect merits to support that. So when we say change our luck, that's the luck we should change. So that's why we make offerings to the three jewels. We serve our gurus. We study the Dharma. We meditate. We chant. We recite mantras. Do retreats. Go on pilgrimages. Offer incense. Offer jasti. Serve the Sangha. Do charity works, etc., etc., etc. That's the reason to collect merits, to be able to support the growth of those realizations. When you can support the growth of those realizations, your sufferings lessen and eventually stop. That's why the purification of negative karma and the collection of positive karma is so crucial and important in our practice. We may think making offerings on our altar, cleaning, doing our prayers is so menial and so small, and it's not real Dharma practice. Wrong view. Anything done in relation to the enlightened being creates extremely powerful propensity. How much we put into it is how much we will get back. Buddha Shakyamuni himself said, when asked by one of his disciples, Kungawa, when the Buddha is alive and when the Buddha is present, making offerings to the three jewels in the form of Buddha Shakyamuni, we collect great amount of merit and we are able to destroy vast amounts of negative karma. When the Buddha is not physically here anymore, what shall we do? Then the Buddha replied, my four disciples. That relates to a class of disciples. My four types of disciples. When I am not around, making offerings to an image in the likeness of myself and believing it is me will be equal to making offerings to me in person and directly. So when we have holy images of Buddhas and put beautiful ornaments, put gold, and make beautiful offerings and make a place for them and make an effort for them, it is the same as having the actual living Buddhas themselves in your presence. And any actions that you do within their presence is the same as the amount of merit you will collect if you actually did it to them in person. And that is a direct quote from Buddha Shakyamuni himself, not one of his disciples, not an Indian pandit, not a Tibetan guru or master. That is from Buddha Shakyamuni himself. So we should be ever persevering in making offerings, maintaining our altar, making prostrations, making mandala, vajrasattva, doing our meditational deities, studying up on the Dharma, meditating, practicing, and most important, applying it in our daily lives. In fact, we should be ever persevering, because that will become the root cause for cutting out suffering. So we should contemplate. We should not be like a cup with holes. We hear it, we say, yes, it's correct, pray, we go home, we go back to the same thing, day after day, month after month, year after year, with no improvements and some danger of degeneration. So we should be like a cup without the holes and retain it. Think about it, contemplate on it, study it, and especially collect merits to support it. If we don't, we can be in Dharma for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. We will never change, we will never transform. In fact, the ego becomes bigger. I'm a senior Dharma practitioner. You should listen to me. You can think that. I'm a senior Dharma practitioner. I've met 20 Rinpoches. I'm a senior Dharma practitioner. I've done 50 rainy season retreats. Wonderful. But you're still going to hell. You're still suffering. Wonderful. Let me see the physical results. No offense. The results should be obvious. A changing and transformation of your character. So let's not leave the Dharma talk despondent. We should leave the Dharma talk happy that we have some kind of realization and apply and try to make a change in our lives and transform. Now, this moment, today, from today on, and maintain it by study, practice, and the relationship with our gurus, if we have one. We should maintain it. And by that constant nurturing, like a small child, it will grow into adulthood, able to protect and watch itself, able to take care of itself. Like that, definitely these realizations will come to the point where they are irreversible, where without effort, they remain steady and constant. Effortless enthusiasm, effortless patience, effortless bodhicitta, effortless compassion, effortless giving. It will become effortless. On that basis, all phenomena are empty of true existence. Therefore, all phenomena are free of inherent existence, not existing on its own right. It is existing on causes. Since it is existing on causes, once we cut the causes, it cannot exist anymore. When